Dave or somebody else would be better able to respond to that from a legal point of view. We have a long relationship with those organizations that you mentioned, Catholic Community Services, Lutheran Family Services, and the like. And we not only do they get federal funds, but they get contracts with our department. And it's a long-standing relationship, and my hope would be, and I understand what this fear is. Anytime you open up anything, there can be all kinds of questions, and who knows what lurks in the minds of lawyers, right? I mean, as the shadow would say. But we for a long time have had relationships, and I would hope that we could build on that and the safeguards we built in with those relationships, so that we could go forward and make this something that would work for us. But I can't respond to how other lawyers may react to it.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, you know, we had we've been dealing with a similar issue when ODOT asked the question of whether certain expenditures were in accordance with the Constitution, only to find out a recommendation came from AG's office saying you might want to change your ways. The important thing is, though, we need to resolve this. I think you pointed out aptly that if you go back not many years, there was no question that we would be cooperating between faith-based and government and trying to meet the needs of our citizens. So, you know, if it turns out that we get pushed backwards a little ways in this relationship, it may really help us to move forward to get a true clarification of what was, in fact, the intent of our Constitution. And, I, you know, since, in fact, I'm just going to share a little Bible here with you. The word ecclesia means those individuals who are called out, okay? There is no way, if you look at constitutional law, that you could any way assume that if government could, in fact, interfere with their actions, because it's individual, therefore be a right of freedom of speech. I know that we've complicated that because the state now goes in and authorizes a church, you know, by our corporate structure, but at the same time, it may be a good time to get some of these things clarified.
Thanks, Senator George, for the comment. Hearing none, Bobby, would you stay there just a moment? We're going to go back, I think, and revisit that.
Yeah.
We vote on that.
Right. I want to, under the rubric of questions to Mr. Mink, I didn't want to make any other comments, but I do want to say what I have done in response to the concern that's been raised. And that is, when it was brought forward, I had a conversation with the representative of the Oregon Catholic Conference. I then had a conversation with the Chief Justice about the issue. I had a conversation with the Law Commission. Of course, Bobby, you and I talked. I had a conversation with the head of the Jewish Community Services all around this issue of, do you want to open the question or not? And the consensus was, and I'm serious when I say this, I guess you can only take my word for it, but the consensus was that while you never know quite what will happen when you get lawyers looking at an issue, but this is some law professors, it's a Supreme Court justice, a couple justices, it's three legislators. Preponderance is that we've got more to gain by settling the issue. There's a long history, and after all of the organizations that express concern are 501c3s. They have that protection. They're separate entities that are used to dealing with government for a long time, so there's a lot to be gained. In fact, I even had a conversation this morning with the president of the NCSL, who happened to be on our Senate floor, about this issue. And he made the comment that we might be doing the whole country a favor by pursuing this issue, because it's something that just hasn't been studied.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I'd move the -3 amendments. Senate Joint Resolution 39.
Senator Shields has moved -3 amendments to the Senate Joint Resolution 39. Is there further discussion? I just would like to say that probably had you not brought these -3 amendments here, we would be having a work session on this bill, because I have some very firm convictions along those lines, too, that these legal aspects need to be very closely pursued. We have Senator Brown sitting here in the chair. Senator, did you wish to weigh in on this?
I just came to talk to the preacher, but I didn't know he was about to give a sermon, so my timing was off.
But her timing is good, because she's a member of the Oregon Law Commission, and this is going to you.
Great.
And I knew how long he was going to talk, so I offered her a seat.
I'm glad my members have courtesy here. I didn't think of doing that.
I'm going to get even with both of you.
Is there further discussion?
I thought they were getting even with Peter and I for this morning.
Or objections? Hearing none, so ordered, the amendments have passed to SJR 39.
Mr. Chair, I move SJR 39 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Yeah, we have to adopt these. Did we move the last one?
I thought we moved.
We'll have to go back.
We just got through moving the amendment.
We have to adopt the we could adopt the amendments and adopt it.
We moved the amendments, can't we?
We already moved the amendments, right?
So we adopt the...
Okay, so the language is...
Move to adopt.
Move to adopt Senate Joint Resolution 39 as amended. And send it to the floor.
Due pass.
With a due pass recommendation, okay.
Senator Shields has moved that we adopt Senate Joint Resolution 39 and send it as amended and send it to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will clerk call a roll?
Senator Leggett?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye, and Senator Carter is excused, and Senator Shields will carry this also. Fourth session on Joint Resolution 39.
You want to go back to six now?
Yeah, I'll have to have your...
Oh, yes. Mr. Chair, I ask for unanimous consent to suspend the rules and go back to a work session on Senate Joint Memorial 6.
Hearing no objections, so ordered.
Two things we wanted to do here. One was give Bobby a chance if he wanted to comment on the memorial to the Congress and the President of the United States, if he has any comments he wants to make on that.
Also change that to an adoption rather than a move.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to have to also go back and vote.
Okay, you want to do that first, Bobby first? Any comments?
Yes, let's take Bobby's testimony, and then I'll have you move to change the, and then we'll all vote again.
Okay.
Apologize.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Bob Mink, Interim Director for the Department of Human Services. And really, Mr. Chair, I guess I would say about the same thing for this that I would before. Can we incorporate my previous comments into this resolution as well?
Certainly can.
We went backwards.
Do you want me to get in for a second?
That'd be fine. Well, anybody else, I suppose, could. We now have to go back and erase the vote that we had, or can we note our error and change the... we are noting an error we made in not using the word adopt in the previous motion on Senate Joint Memorial 6. So I will now entertain a motion to get that word in the record. Senator Shields, you ready?
And I'm supposed to say make a motion to adopt Senate Joint Memorial 6 and send it to the...
As amended.
As amended, and send it to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Shields moves to adopt Senate Joint Memorial 6 as amended and send it to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Hearing no further discussion and no objections, will the clerk call a roll?
Senator Medley?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Shields will carry the bill. And Senator Carter is excused. I'm closing the work session on Senate Joint Resolution excuse me, Senate Joint Memorial 6, and opening a hearing on Senate Bill 768, and we will invite Senator Hannon, who has arrived very timely, to speak to his bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, for the record. My name is Len Hannon, State Senator, District 26. Senate Bill 768 is a bill that I introduced because I feel it's a bill that addresses a critical concern in employers being able to afford good quality health insurance. What this bill attempts to do is allow small employers, whether they're self-employed, medium-sized employers, or large employers, to form an association for the purposes of buying health insurance, thereby collectively spreading the risk amongst themselves. It's interesting that we talk about availability and affordability of health insurance, but we do very little to lighten the burden on employers being able to buy health insurance. Currently, the existing insurance code prohibits the formation of any group for the purchase of forming an association to buy health insurance. This bill would amend that to allow similar businesses to join together and form a larger employer group to purchase health insurance. As an insurance agent who has dealt with employers, it has been one of their critical issues of sometimes if one or two employees and one person has a major health problem, it either affects cancellation or it affects substantial premium increases because of the one person. This would be allowing them to come together collectively to form a group to purchase health insurance in a larger block, thereby spreading the risk and hopefully attempting to keep the insurance premium cost down. I would be willing to try to respond to any questions that you might have.
I have one here. As I looked over the bill, you have deleted the monetary amounts on Section 2. Subsection 6, which is deleted now, subsection 5. And what figures do you anticipate putting in there, or would this like have to go to the Ways and Means Committee to have those figures added, or?
It's possible that that's a figure that would have to come down to Ways and Means. We'd have to look at the fiscal impact and be able to address it down there. I don't know if the bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
No, it doesn't. And it doesn't.
I would certainly support referring it down to Ways and Means.
I didn't know whether something like that, where that wasn't an actual cost that I could see was. It's concerning the contributions of an employee. Annual gross contributions to benefit a certain amount for vision and dental and any other plan. So it's not actually asking for money, it's just asking for figures in there. But I didn't know what you had.
What I was trying to do is create.
Reducing them or raising them or.
What I was trying to do, Mr. Chairman, was trying to reduce the high cost and make it as flexible as possible for employers to be able to meet collectively to purchase a block of health insurance.
You raised a question here because I belong to an association that has gone out and worked toward getting insurance for their members, and where it had the same trade originally or industry, would that same trade have included, for instance, nursing homes as a certain trade group?
Well,
and assisted living that might have belonged to the same
under the existing
trade?
Under the existing insurance code, you can go out and buy as an association as long as you're not joined for the purpose of creating a block to buy health insurance. If you're an association, as an example, that provides membership services to an employer group, you can do that as part of the ancillary program of belonging to that association. Where the prohibition comes is when you mix different groups of businesses in to a larger group.
So in other words, under the existing law, if I were to just do something on my own without a trade group, or without an association, a membership,
such as the Chamber of Commerce,
then I would have had to, as a private nursing home, I would have had to go into my neighboring nursing home and another nursing home and put together a group of strictly nursing homes. I couldn't have had a nursing home, an assisted living facility, a retirement facility. They would have had to have all retirement facilities or all assisted living facilities.
Correct.
Okay. I just wasn't sure here. So now, in similar trade, we could get together all in the long-term care industry and maybe adult foster care homes and homes for the aged, retirement homes, the whole bit could get together under your...
Yes.
Okay. I wasn't sure for certain that I've not had a training or any background much in the insurance industry. I'm sorry, you didn't get a chance to read this in the record. Or didn't you? Pardon? Oh, I see. Read it. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I... Okay. I've got several... letters and emails that I wish to read into the record here. This is one from... Sandra Slattery. She is the Executive Director of the Agriculture Chamber of Commerce and support. Valerie Williams, Ashland Area Chamber of Commerce President. Larry Steiner, and he served Small Business Organizations in Oregon. Dennis E. Sweet, veterinarian, also associated with the Ashland Chamber of Commerce. Donna A. Welsh, co-owner of the Artesian Press in Ashland. James R. Watson is the administrator of Ashland Community Hospital. And James E. Teese, he's the president and CEO of Project A Incorporated. I don't see an address where that is. We will include those in the record.
Thank you.
Any further questions, Senator Hannon? We appreciate you taking your time.
Thank you.
Coming down, and we have some others to testify, and you're more than welcome to stay here in case you'd like to hear the testimonies. Okay, we've got the Regents Group, Ruth Rogers Bauman, and Lisa Trussell and Peggy Anna. Go right ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Ruth Rogers Bauman. I'm a Vice President of Actuarial Monitoring Services for the Regents Group, located in Portland, Oregon. I'd like to offer some comments about the proposed bill, which changes the size of groups that could qualify as a MEWOF or as a grouping of accounts that might be covered for insurance. We feel there are a number of concerns with this bill, although we are sympathetic with the issues regarding accessibility to coverage for small groups and coverage for all Oregonians. First, we believe that by allowing small employers to group together in relatively small associations or groupings would subvert the C-HI rating requirements.
Which?
The C-HI, the small employer health insurance requirements.
You'll have to excuse us. Most of us are not just totally familiar with all the acronyms.
Well, let me describe that a little bit. Since 1989, the state of Oregon has had regulations in place when they implemented Senate Bill 1076. Since that time, there have been a number of other reforms that went into place, which were to address the accessibility of insurance coverage for small employers. The intent of those regulations was to level the playing field for small employers, to remove some of the types of behaviors or market practices which were felt to keep small employers from gaining health insurance coverage. Some of those, for example, allowed in the past for either employers or for carriers to eliminate certain employees and groups. There were rating practices that seemed to be harsh and limited the number of people who were covered. Since those regulations have come into effect in the last few years, we now have a guaranteed issue market in Oregon so that all small employers may seek out coverage provided they meet some minimum requirements. There are also some rating rules in effect which attempt to provide fair community rating for small employers. Those rules were put into effect in order, as part of the overall Oregon Health Plan, to provide more insurance for individuals across the state. Once individuals are grouped together and are removed from the regulation of the C-HI rules, then we believe we would subvert those types of regulations which were aimed at improving accessibility for small employers. We do recognize that after a number of years, there are probably opportunities to improve on the foundation that Oregon has built, but we suggest that we look to improving those rules rather than finding ways to subvert them. The second issue, which is a concern, is that we believe that allowing relatively small groups of individuals to group together for the purpose of obtaining health insurance would result in very small populations that really could not take on the risk that would be present when you group together for insurance and are experience rated. As such, they may find themselves unable to have coverage in the future. Lastly, we also think that there is a problem in that because there is no financial tie among accounts to group together in this way, there may be issues about financial disputes that arise when it comes time to share risk under those plans, whether it be through experience rating or it might be through some sort of financial arrangement, such as an administrative services arrangement whereby the individuals pay or the employers take on a very large share of the risk for the pool itself. All of those issues we think would expose employers who might enter into these arrangements to far more risk than they are consider now into going into it, and therefore it would harm them financially and in the future would make it difficult for them to have coverage.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America. And I'm going to try and be brief and just identify some of the issues that are attendant with this. This is, as you've heard me testify before, affordability for employers, particularly in the small group market, is a significant issue, and I think it's something that we're all concerned about. When we get into this level of detail, though, I think oftentimes the financial underpinnings are not well enough understood to realize that perhaps some of these proposals need to be reexamined to see what could be made workable. And for that reason, I handed in copies of the requirements, statutory requirements for an association plan. And while I appreciate Senator Hannon's approach to trying to reduce the size for a MIWA, there are some significant issues. A MIWA is a specific term that is used under ERISA, the federal law that governs employee benefit plans. And under ERISA, in order to be a MIWA, you cannot be a group that's solely formed for the purposes of delivering insurance. You have to be an association or some other sort of group entity in order to qualify for the sort of treatment that is afforded under ERISA. So that's key. There's another section of the code, the Department of Labor ERISA requirements, where such activities are allowed, but they have different sets of rules and regulations that are associated with those. Those are called group insurance arrangements. But going back directly to the Oregon statutes, because of the financial liability issues and concerns over the liabilities in the event such groups would be formed, Oregon has enacted a number of statutes over a period of time organizing these, and to show the complexity of this, even if you reduce the number of employers down to two with a minimum group size of 50, that group of two would still have to require some sort of capital or surplus in the form of $250,000 or 35% of the incurred claims for the past year, whichever happened to be greater. If you would go through these statutes that I handed in, you will notice there are a number of financial requirements. So even if you were to act on the proposal to reduce the number of employers and the employees, it's unlikely, in my view, that the group would be able to qualify under the statutory provisions because of the financial protections that pertain to these groups overall in the statutes. It would be quite a task to go back in and revise these financial liability protections that are in existing statute to actually make these kinds of proposals affordable for a group of two employers at the 50 employee or so level. And just one comment on something that Ruth said. Having worked with groups of employers before, I had a specific experience with a group of two employers that joined together. One had about 100 employees and the other had about 40. And they had bought a common insurance plan, actually. Well, when they started reviewing the experience, when the smaller group had bad risk, the larger group said, well, that's the end of the deal. You know, we're not going to cover your losses. And there's nothing in here that protects those kinds of circumstances, which is sort of the underlying rationale that has led to some of the language that exists within the self-insurance section, for example, for self-insured employers within the public sector. And I know that's more complicated than what you wanted to hear, but nonetheless, there are background issues that affect this, and I'd be happy to talk to Senator Hannon further about this to explain, for example, what a group insurance arrangement is under the federal ERISA provisions. Thank you.
Do you see any common ground for maybe some improvement or some change to this, going back to what Ms. Bauman said, concerning the strengthening or weakening? Well, it's pretty hard sometimes to strengthen one thing without weakening the other, even though you maybe have to make some changes. And so I don't maybe know how you could accomplish one without the other. You know, we actually, through the small insurance plans were developed, weakened one of our programs that the state had, that we got rid of it. I guess I don't mean to suggest necessarily that we would be at the position where we'd want to get rid of our small plan policies, but are we getting to the point where we somehow or another need to give a little bit of a shot in the arm to some of these smaller employers? That's
Senator Fisher, we've been involved in numerous discussions over the session about how to deal with the issues not only in the small group, but in the individual market and the large group market. And I think that there are a number of folks in the building that are interested in coming up with some way of dealing with making it affordable, frankly, across the board. And I, I know that for...
There were at least 14 of us in the Senate.
In any event, I think it's a challenge. I know that people are still working on that. And I think that in terms of Senator Hanna's proposal here, there are operational issues that, you know, that undermine his concept in terms of, you know, federal law. As I said, I'd be happy to explain to him these group insurance arrangements so that the folks that he knows that are interested in this may want to, you know, explore what that means and whether or not they happen to fit into that sort of an arrangement.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lisa Tressel with Associated Oregon Industries, and I think Ruth and Peggy have already touched on some of the concerns that we had or questions with the bill, primarily the impact on the prior small group reform legislation that's been passed, the historical background on fictitious groups and grouping as far as being able to cherry pick, and would that disadvantage or advantage more or disadvantage more, those questions. The issue that Peggy raised with group insurance arrangements that are currently allowed under federal law. And so those were just some of the questions that we had about how this bill would impact.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Bruce Fisher.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop here on behalf of the Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Northwest. First off, I'd like to apologize to the committee and to the sponsor of the bill because I did not have an opportunity to hear his testimony at another hearing. And so I'm not sure that I understand fully what his goal is with regard to the legislation. I can guess that it is to address concerns about affordability and the availability of insurance, particularly in his community in Southern Oregon, where they have had a very volatile market.
We've got him still here, and I think he told us that, and I would paraphrase his statement that he did wish to pursue ways of trying to make insurance more affordable to more of the small businesses.
That would be my guess. Thank you for that confirmation. What I would like to suggest to the committee is that there may be another way to address that issue than the way this bill is drafted. And that way is provisions in existing law that allow there is provision in existing law for association plans to be the recipient of a group health policy. There are requirements about what those association plans are, but I think there is a plausible interpretation of that statute that gets it out from under the multiple employer welfare arrangement requirements that are addressed in Senate Bill 768. Those existing provisions for association plans qualifying for group health insurance are set forth in ORS 743-524. And I think it may, depending again on the specific issues and ways that Senator Hannon wants to proceed, there may be ways working within that statute to accomplish the same purpose without creating more instability in the group health insurance market by modifying MEWA requirements that would apply not just in Southern Oregon, but would apply throughout the state. And that would be Kaiser Permanente's concern, that we create opportunities across the state and not just address the specific problem in Southern Oregon, which is Senator Hannon's principal concern, I'm sure. Again, we think that there may be some avenues that could be pursued constructively within existing statute to look at this problem, and we would be glad to work with the committee and with Senator Hannon to both better understand and advance those kinds of solutions. Thank you.
You might be able to help me out a little bit. I was pursuing the definitions here of similar and same trade ideas, and I noticed that there's one even little expansion of that here in 750.307, section 1. You may not, do you have that with you?
The bill, yes, sir.
No, not the bill. This is the ORS. Is
301.
750.307.
Yes, I have
section 1. Where it says association or group must be composed of 5 or more employers that are in the same trade or industry, including employers in closely related businesses, that, and defining that as support, services, or supplies primarily for that trade or industry. Well, again, I go back to my health care because that's what I'm familiar with, and I can do draw good examples there better. We get quite a few of our clients back and forth through the long-term care facility. Would that then qualify, say, for instance, instead of having to go through an association group or a trade group of straight nursing homes, could we then deviate and say under this that, for instance, a home for the adult foster care home might supply my nursing home with the clients, and I also might be utilizing them as sending clients to them? Would that include a related business here under this definition?
Mr. Chair.
Or would it have to be a material supply or a...
I believe it would include a related business of that type. It may even be possible that under the current law where it says same trade or industry, depending on how those are defined, that you know, some of those other groups could be in the same trade or industry. They are certainly all health care. They may all be health long-term care, and the question is whether there's a division between nursing home and foster care homes, for example, or not. I would think that in that instance, those would be in the same business or industry, even if they're different types of businesses. The language in the bill that would expand that to include same or similar obviously raises it to a somewhat higher level, but I don't know what would necessarily be a similar trade. Maybe between a long-term care facility and a hospital, maybe those are similar, but they might not be the same trade, but they might be.
Well, how about a motel, hotel, lodging?
I would expect those could be similar, yes. So this, under the bill, it would broaden the requirements that they be related. Again, under the alternative that I suggested, there needs to be an association that would be the group policyholder, and that would generally mean that you were related if you were the Oregon Healthcare Association, for example, for nursing home care, or the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems for hospital care, or the Oregon Bankers Association, or whatever the association, those would be related members who are in that same business. But it's my belief, at least, that language also would allow a Chamber of Commerce to be the association whose members would be qualified to participate in the Chamber's health benefit plan under this association language. And that's why I say there may be additional ways to get the same result more easily than redesigning all of the MIWA requirements in current law.
I guess it's hard for me to see exactly what you're talking about without understanding a little better the legal definition here, because when I see similar and related now as like this, I'm sitting here saying, well, I get grocery supplies delivered to me by a grocery warehouse service or something like that. So they're supplying me supplies. Now can I band together with them? Although we're totally, you know, I'm in a healthcare business, but they're bringing me supplies, and then my janitorial supply person, could I expand out that way? And if so, could they then draw in people in that manufactured their brooms and dustpans? I mean, it seems to me almost like the way it's written here, you could, and I'm wondering just how lax or something the federal rules would allow, because I'm understanding now after some of the testimony that perhaps there's some federal issues that we're dealing with here too that maybe have a little more clear-cut definition maybe than we're dealing with.
Mr. Chair, there are some federal rules that I can't even describe to you because I don't understand them, but there are some qualification requirements under federal law for being a multiple employer welfare arrangement. I think under existing state law, as you suggested, what is a qualified group is open. It says including employers in closely related businesses that provide support services or supplies primarily to that trade or industry. So suppliers of services to a business can also qualify in a multiple employer arrangement under current law. But I can't describe how far those relationships can go before they're disqualified, and that may be something that somebody else could help the committee with.
What if we, for instance, say, perhaps, just for argument's sake, or not argument or discussion's sake, left the word, for instance, that had been added here, instead of changed from 5 to 2 and 250, if we left that the same, but changed in the and added the word similar over here, and so we didn't make it a lesser, smaller group, but we would allow a little broader expansion of the definition of who could join.
That would clearly, I think, adding similar would expand the potential for those who could join without adjusting the numbers. So those are dynamics that the committee could make.
And in your opinion, would that make it somewhat more financially responsible and perhaps making it too small of a grouping or too small of a dollar value?
Again, without, Mr. Chair,
I don't realize I'm putting you on the spot. I'm just trying to educate myself here to see if there's ways that would be worth pursuing here to try to maybe, in light of what they're saying, and make some changes rather than detract from or...
Clearly adding similar would expand the pool that were potentially eligible to join, so that would allow for more flexibility. As I was suggesting in my testimony, I think there may be an alternative way to do that through the association approved coverage laws, and it may be possible to do that without even tinkering with these statutes here. And I think it could get to the same result.
Need to gavel down to a subcommittee for hearing.
That's my testimony.
Well, thank you. I'll let you go ahead here.
That's all I have.
Oh, okay.
Thank you very much.
I wondered, Senator Hannon, would you be willing to come? If you didn't know before I was out of my element, you sure know it now by the questions I've asked.
No, that's fine, Mr. Chair. It's interesting that the health insurance industry comes in and says the chamber can do it, but yet the insurance commissioner says it's prohibited because you have same people belonging to an association but different jobs, different variety of employers. They're not collectively the same. So the way the interpretation is being expressed here today by the health insurance industry versus what the health or the insurance lobby of the commissioner's office is two total different worlds. The reason this bill is here is the Ashland Chamber of Commerce wanted to be the, in essence, third-party administrator for a group of employers that wanted to join together to purchase a block of health insurance. They were told they couldn't do it. And now we hear today, oh yes, they can. So maybe if these arguments are so sustaining that they're that secure in their definition, maybe they should convey the same message to the insurance commissioner, because that's sure as hell not the way it's being interpreted in the insurance commissioner's office.
Well, I'm a little disappointed that the insurance commissioner isn't here, and before we do a work session on this, I'm definitely going to get in contact and ask him to weigh in on this and give us the benefit of their practices, at least, for the committee education, and I would be more than happy to, you have time and the inclination to try to work a little bit here to see...
That's fine, I'd be willing to work.
Do you have a conflict of interest between what actually should be in the law and what our insurance commission is doing?
I don't have a market in this, so my dog's not in this fight. I'm just trying to help some constituents who had...
Well, I was thinking that you have a little more experience in not only the insurance and industry, but you know the thinking of your people down there in the situation so that you can answer questions and approach it from an angle that I can't.
But I approached the insurance commissioner's office, and they said they can't do it. Now we hear from the industry people today that they can do it. So somebody is giving us a catch-22 here, and it'd be helpful to get somebody from the commissioner's office here to state on the record why they can't do it.
Do we have anybody from the insurance commissioner's office here? They told my administrator yesterday they would be here. So is anyone here from the, has not identified themselves or is hiding behind a chair? I don't see any. So what we'll do, Senator Hannon, I believe, is definitely we'll contact them and we'll pull this back for further work and we'll have them go on record as to what their definition is and why their definition is, and maybe they can tell us a little bit more too about maybe some of the federal restrictions that they feel they're under or that they're operating with or something like that. And is that satisfactory?
That's fine.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll do that, and thank you for waiting down here for your time. Appreciate it. Public hearing on Senate Bill 768 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 246.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. Senate Bill 246 authorizes the Oregon State Board of Nursing to prescribe standards and approve curricula for education programs that prepare our nurse anesthetist, clinical nurse specialists and nurse practitioners for certification. This bill was heard originally in February, and we do have Dash 1 amendments attached, as well as our gross copy of the bill attached to your summary. In short, the amendments require the Board of Nursing, to prescribe and approve curriculum for nursing education programs only that prepare nurses for registered nurse or licensed practical nurse status. It requires the Board to consult with graduate nursing education programs and does require the Board to provide for surveys for nursing education programs that prepare nurses for registered nurse or licensed practical nurse only.
See, we have Marna Flaherty here to testify. Did you have someone bring with you? That's fine.
Chairman and fellow senators, I'm Marna Flaherty Robb, Director of Practice Development.
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed your last name.
That's right. Okay. Marna Flaherty Robb.
I thought that was your PhD.
It's a long name. Director of Practice Development at the School of Nursing, and my associate is Catherine Salveson. We are here simply to state that these amendments reach compromise among the parties involved with this bill. And we agree with all the editing comments, and we believe our partners do as well, and we're hoping that they will be supported.
Okay. We don't have anyone here to argue against that, and that, see, that was the dash...
Sorry, it was the dash one amendment.
Dash one? Okay. Been running so many different numbers through. Get it here on these amendments that I wasn't sure... Okay, is there any opportunity to get another member here? appreciate you taking the time to come down again and
thank you for hearing us.
And work on this, and appreciate the work that's been done.
Yes.
Outside of
that's right. We feel that
you don't know how much help it is. I realize how much help it is to do some of this work outside of committee because of our limited time. Plus, in fact, I think things slide along a little better sometimes without the
I think so too.
Pressure of all the general public having their eyes and ears on the whole procedure.
Well, thanks so much for your support and facilitation, and our colleagues are all in agreement. We expect it to go forward, we hope.
Yeah, I now have a full committee, so I'll gavel back to the full committee, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 246, and open a work session on Senate Bill 246. I would entertain a motion to accept -1 amendments.
Okay.
Senator Shields has
he's in a good mood.
Okayed the move to include the -1 amendments in Senate Bill 246. Is there further discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Guess we have an amendment to carry this along.
Okay.
This and you got to speak, Fido.
Speak, Fido. Okay. Let's see. This time, can I move rather than adopt?
Yes.
Is that okay?
Yes, you may.
I'm used to moving.
I know. Especially in natural resources.
In natural resources, we move a lot, but we haven't adopted anything all year, you know, so it's kind of tough. I move Senate Bill 246 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. How's that? Does that cover it for you?
That's excellent.
Senator Fido.
Senator Shields has moved Senate Bill 246 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Objection? Hearing none. Will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Mayfield.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Senator Fisher.
Aye. And Senator George and Senator Carter are excused. And
go ahead. Close it up.
You want to carry it?
I'll carry on anytime you want me to.
Senator Mesley, I don't want to.
Whatever.
I don't want to keep you out of the action.
If he wants to carry it, that's fine.
No. Just yes. Let him carry it.
We'll have Senator Mesley carry it. Senate Bill 246, and it is passed.
Now that you've closed the hearing, I just want to say.
Close public hearing on Senate Bill 246.
And before we go into another one, I just want to say that I've been accused of a lot of puns, but Senator Messerly just said in natural resources rather than moving a bill, we move a bill. Cows.
It's time to adjourn.
I'm sorry. You keep getting it. It's his.
I did.
It's a moving experience.
I did. I gaveled out.
Yeah.
Did I miss going from public hearing to?
So you gaveled out of the public hearing. You need to gavel out of.
I did just before he made the statement.
Okay.
She will tell you that.
Okay. I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 567. Staff will introduce.
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 567 prohibits the Department of Human Services from entering into an exclusive contract for provision of durable medical equipment for recipients of medical assistance. This bill was heard on April 9th, and we do have -2 amendments to this bill, which are attached, and as well as in a gross copy. In essence, the -2 amendments include medical devices and supplies as items that may not be included in sole source contracts, but does exclude eyeglasses and hearing aids from the measure.
Okay. We'll ask Lynn Reed and Jeff Hetherington.
Excuse me. Chair Fisher, members of the committee, I'm Lynn Reed, the Assistant Administrator with the Department of Human Services Office of Medical Assistance Programs. I did testify previously on the introduced version of the bill and would like to take this opportunity to make comments on the Dash 2 amendment. The department does oppose the Dash 2 amendment because it would prohibit us from employing prudent business strategies, and they do have a cost that is not anticipated in the governor's budget. As I mentioned in my previous testimony, during the course of this biennium, we did convene an ancillary services committee to look at ways to contain costs in what we call ancillary services, which include durable medical equipment and medical supplies. And we had a number of stakeholders who participated in those meetings, including our managed care plans and providers. One of the ways our managed care plans save money is by employing sole source contracting in order to take advantage of volume discounts. And one of the recommendations that came out of that committee was to move forward with doing some sole source contracting for incontinence supplies. And we are currently engaged in that procurement process to sole source incontinence supplies. This would apply to our clients who are in our fee-for-service system. It would not apply to clients enrolled in our managed care plans, as plans are separately determined who they're going to contract with. It also would not apply to residents in nursing homes. At the previous hearing, some concerns were expressed by committee members and some of the individuals who testified on the bill as to how the program would operate if we were to sole source incontinence supplies. And so I wanted to take the opportunity to describe how we envision that program operating. A prescription would be mailed or faxed to the sole source vendor. However, an initial 30-day supply could be obtained from a local vendor in the community if that worked best for the individual. Normal standard orders would routinely be filled and received by the client at his or her address or residence within 72 hours. Urgent orders would be filled and received by the client within 36 hours. The contract vendor would also take on the responsibility of notifying the prescribing practitioner when the designated number of refills on the original prescription were about to run out, so that there wouldn't be any break in coverage for the client. We would also require that the contract vendor have customer service and quality assurance procedures in place. That would include registered nurse consultation with staff experienced particularly in problems related to incontinence supplies. We believe that any sole source contracting that OMAP would engage in would have appropriate safeguards in place to ensure clients receive appropriate high-quality services. In addition, we have accepted responsibility to be prudent purchasers with public funds. We oppose this bill not only because of its cost related to incontinence supplies, which is estimated at 10% of that $7 million budget item, but because it would restrict our ability in the future to expand this effective means of containing medical costs. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Mensah.
I still have concerns about this bill, even with the explanation. Who supplies these, who provides the supplies within the 72 hours or within the 36 hours?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miserly, we would, as a part of our procurement process, we are going to out seeking bids, and this is one of the requirements before we would enter into a contract with a vendor, would be that they would indeed provide those services within those time frames.
Mr. Chair, if I could say that again. If you get out of a hospital or you're out of a nursing home, where would you get the supplies before they would be shipped by the sole provider?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miserly, that initial prescription could be filled by a local vendor up to a 30-day supply.
Mr. Chair, just comment, that is one of my concerns, because the local vendors, I don't believe, can survive only on the incidental supplies such as that, and at least that's what I've kind of testimony I've heard from my constituents in my district. Also, I heard during the hearing, one of the hearings that you spoke of in preparation for that, that and there was testimony, I believe, at the hearing that there was oversupply, simply because if someone passed away or went in the hospital, that the central supplier would continue to ship supplies. And so there was testimony of garages or rooms full of supplies that just kept coming. How have you resolved that situation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Meserle, I don't have a specific answer to that, but that definitely would be an issue that that we would look into in order to set up a process that would help us avoid sending unwanted, unneeded supplies.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Meserle, are you referring to the Dash 2 amendments?
I think so.
Okay. I just want to make sure that I understood that, which I guess only talks to including supplies, it's added supplies in here.
Which it does include supplies, right?
Yeah, the first one, as I recall, didn't spell it out.
Mr. Chair,
you just spoke to durable medical equipment, but you're objecting to not having durable equipment written out of there also, right?
I think so, because that was the concern that I heard a lot of testimony on, was the incontinence supplies primarily, but others, I'm concerned about other supplies as well.
Well, my understanding was that the durable medical supplies were not going out to a sole source, were they?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. At this time, we only have a sole source contract related to durable medical equipment with a vendor for eyeglasses, and we've been engaged in a procurement process related to hearing aids, both of which are specifically exempted in the Dash 2 amendments. But it's my understanding that this would prohibit us from any future sole source contracting related to other durable medical equipment,
yeah,
or other medical supplies beyond the incontinence supplies that we're currently engaged in procuring.
Now, our small medical suppliers, the local medical suppliers, are not buying hearing aids and eyeglasses either, are they?
Mr. Chair, I do know that we work with a sole source contractor on eyeglasses for our fee-for-service.
Well, what I mean is, for instance, I'll just give you an example that I know of, Rick's Medical in Roseburg. I don't think they handle eyeglasses or hearing aids. They would be strictly in the medical equipment, both durable and supplies.
Mr. Chair, I agree that I would expect that those businesses are separate businesses in terms of eyeglasses and the local supplier of equipment such as hospital beds or wheelchairs.
And as amended, this would then require that you still deal through the local groups with durable and single-use supplies.
Mr. Chair, that is indeed how we also interpret the amendment.
And, Mr. Chair?
Yes,
Senator. Did I read this right? You can find it again. That this will save, could you describe again the savings to the state and what this could mean to local economies, as well as what it can mean to service?
Mr. Chair, Senator Meserle, we are anticipating that through a sole source vendor, we would save approximately 10% on what we currently expend for incontinence supplies, which is what our fiscal is based on. And that budget is estimated to be a $7 million budget, total funds, in the next biennium. 10% of that would be the $700,000 savings. And the state portion of that is $285,000 general fund. In terms of the impact on local business, indeed, we're moving the majority of those expenditures to the sole source vendor. And so, you know, a local vendor who, you know, most local vendors will have a single contract. And so there will be an impact on their business to the degree that that business is funds their operating margins and profit margins. And I don't know to what degree, what percentage of a firm's business Medicaid fee-for-service clients are.
Chair,
yes, Senator Medley.
Two more questions. I don't think you answered what this would mean to service to the patients, but also when I was at the hearing previously, I believe the information was that it was going to save the state $90,000. How did we go from $90,000 probably 9 months ago or less to $285,000?
Mr. Chair, Senator Meserle, let me deal with the money part first and then move over to the impact on clients. Although I wasn't involved in doing the pricing for that rule hearing, I do know that that rule had anticipated that we would implement a sole source contract for the last 9 months of the biennium. And so it would have been a 9-month savings as opposed to a 24-month savings, and that would have some impact on the pricing difference. As to the impact on clients, we believe that the process that we're engaged in setting up, which will have a number of points of flexibility in order to meet the needs of clients, that being able to receive the incontinence supplies on a routine basis within 72 hours of the order is a good thing for clients, you know, 36 hours on an urgent basis, and that the vendor will have available a registered nurse with experience in terms of dealing with problems related to incontinence supplies. So it's our intent that we'll have a vendor with expertise that will be there to help find the right product for an individual.
This is the sole source vendor, so.
Correct.
Mr. Chair, that was also another concern that some supplies, types of supplies, just don't work for certain patients. And where you had more local vendors, they could change and find something that was compatible and worked better. And at least I heard a lot of testimony. I believe it was at that hearing that we both attended to, Mr. Chair. I'm just not feeling comfortable that we solved the problem. I'm very concerned about the service that the seniors and elderly people that receive this supplies receive. So, Mr. Chair, I believe I'm going to be a no vote on this.
Yeah. Before we get that far, we're still in a public hearing. And what I'm concerned with is I'm hearing, like my colleague here, totally different figures. I don't see anything in here concerning hiring all the extra personnel that were proposed to be hired in order to make this savings, which to my way of thinking didn't amount. If you, instead of doing that, if you looked over your administration a little bit and cut out a couple of employee positions, you'd save more and got it done cleaner than what you're doing here. And I still fail to see how this works for the private citizen that's out there. We've only talked so far about the inconvenience to a adult foster care home or something like that, where they would maybe have to practically buy a small storage building or something to take care of the process to make sure they had what they needed, instead of being able to go to a local supplier that was set up in a warehouse to do that kind of thing. They could do it for 10 or a dozen or 50 small businesses, instead of each one of them having to do their own. And another thing that I don't see in here is how this affects the private individual that all of a sudden discovers that for some reason or another that they didn't order at the right time. And you're talking about having 36-hour service Do you have private planes to furnish these people to actually fly these things in, and permission from some authority on high to make sure that the weather's capable of doing that? Because we've got a ton of places in the state of Oregon, you're not going to get something in 36 hours from someplace that might even be well out of state if you choose to sole source it to somebody in Chicago or something like that. And I can foresee just a whole big bunch of problems here with individual people doing that, where they're having trouble with keeping things, the track of things away, and discovered at the last minute. I mean, what happens if the hot water heater, for instance, spouts off or something, they freeze a pipe or something, they mess up the last of their supplies in the back closet because they got damaged and they all of a sudden need something. Is it going to be real easy for them to go to a supplier? Is the supplier even going to have these things anymore if they can't afford to stay in business? Those are the things that I'm worried about in a deal like this.
Mr. Chair, there are several issues there I'd like to address. I do recall when you mentioned the staffing issue that at the previous hearing someone had indicated that OMAP was going to put in place 4 additional staff to run this program. We do not anticipate adding any additional staff to operate the program. This will become a responsibility of our program manager for durable medical equipment and supplies and ancillary services to...
Ma'am, that was not somebody's suggestion. That was in the plain and simple hand down from the state of what they were going to do.
Well, Senator Fisher, we do not intend to do that. And I can't, I since I wasn't there and a part of that hearing and haven't seen that document, I can't speak to why it was there before, but I do know that the program that we're moving forward will not have additional staff associated with it.
If that's the case, don't 4 staff cost more than $280,000 for an if you're cutting out 4 staff, you ought to be saving a whale of amount of money here in comparison to what added to the $93,000 that you're going to save in 9 months.
Mr. Chair, there wasn't any assumed expenditure for 4 staff. We don't have 4 staff involved in the program today, and we don't anticipate adding any staff in the sole source contractor program.
You also had a 1.9, as I recall, over 1 million, I think it was 1.9 million effect on the local small suppliers.
Mr. Chair, indeed, there would be a significant impact on local suppliers. That budget is estimated to be a $7 million budget in the 2001-03 biennium, and most of those dollars will go, you know, minus the savings we anticipate from sole sourcing, will go to a single vendor, except for the initial 30-day supply should someone be obtaining that within the community. So that does have an impact on local providers, with a savings to the state from the volume discount purchasing. And
who else is supplying these things besides the vendors out in the community?
Mr. Chair, I believe that, well, I mean, if you mean by vendors in the community, not only medical supply houses, but pharmacies, which I think probably some pharmacies are supplying, which are in the community, are providing the services as well. I am not knowledgeable about the larger supply houses in the state. It may be that Mr. Hetherington, in his testimony, may have some knowledge of that through his managed care business.
Why don't you go ahead, Mr. Hetherington, and we'll hear your testimony.
Yes. My name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm the president of Family Care Incorporated. I'm also the chairman of the Legislative Committee for the Oregon Health Plan Contractors. Here to testify in opposition to the Dash 2s and also the bill in general. The reason why we're opposed is because what this bill prevents is what we consider good business practices on the part of the state. We're looking for the most cost-effective way of delivering the services that they have. Now, one of the things that I think is a little bit of a red herring in this is that there's an assumption sometimes that this applies to the entire Oregon Health Plan population. In fact, it applies to a very small portion of the Oregon Health Plan population, because most of those are covered by fully capitated health plans like Family Care or DOCS out of Coos Bay, or Cascade Comprehensive Care out of Klamath Falls. They cover 100% of the population. And how we durable medical equipment and supplies is we contract with a single source vendor to provide those supplies. So in many cases, what the concern of the committee is about small businesses being cut out, in fact, that's already happened. You know, years ago when the Oregon Health Plan went into effect in 94. Family Care operates in Josephine County, Morrill, Wheeler, and Umatilla counties in the rural areas, and we've used a single source vendor since 1994. I know Cascade Comprehensive Care does, DOCS of Coos County does that, DSIPA uses those, and you know, they're, so we get the best bang for the buck. That single source may have some local contracts, and a lot of times they do have the local contracts, but it's just like the pharmacy benefit managers. We look for the most cost-effective way of delivering those, keeping our costs down, and quite frankly, we think that the state ought to be applauded for trying to do the same thing for the fee-for-service and the open card people. As you certainly know, there is not a whole bunch of extra money for the Oregon Health Plan, and we're having trouble keeping the system going because of the lack of dollars. And the biggest place we're having trouble is not with our local pharmacy suppliers or any other durable medical suppliers, it's with the docs. I mean, if there's anybody who's underpaid in the system, it's family physicians and our specialists. And so anytime we can, you know, we can save money somewhere else so we can divert more money to the physicians, you know, to keep them in the system. And let me tell you, they're not making any money. They're getting less than 50 cents on the dollar now. You know, we'll support that effort, and that's why we're opposed to this bill, because we think it starts draining off money, you know, that quite frankly has to go to some other areas.
I think it's worse than money being drained off.
Well, I think we'd probably agree on that, Senator Fisher, but you know, this is, there's a classic problem of economic interests.
I understand this, but I'm hearing a whole different ball game than we heard and came down to testify. Senator Mesrilli and I both came clear out of our district up here to testify, and we were handed this, and this is what the committee come up with. Now we got a whole set of different figures. We got a whole set of different things of what it's doing, and basically we're not answering the question of how we're serving the person out there.
Well,
I have a concern for some of the people. I have a concern for your HMOs, but I also have a concern for the people that aren't in your HMO.
And let me say that I don't know what the state has presented, and I'm not here to.
And again, the testimony was from the people that have been involved in this. If you're having that big of a problem with the money, why haven't you come to us? In the first place, your so-called committee had about one provider and one or two people at the most from groups, and there was a whole bunch of government types in there. And it wasn't a real, what I would say, Jim Dandy setup of a council or a committee to make some determinations overall to try to protect the people involved that were way out on the end of the receiving line and that kind of thing. And I'm bothered now that all of a sudden we're coming in here with a whole bunch of different excuses, more money we're saving and all this kind of stuff, and it just doesn't add up. In the first place, those people volunteered at the hearing. They said, if you're that hard run and you're trying to save money, come to us and tell us what you can pay or what we'd have to do. We're willing to work with you. And there was absolutely no apparently effort whatsoever that I can find to take up any opportunity to do that. There was also some areas in the requirements of information and stuff where they felt that a lot of money could be being saved in this process. And so I'm not hearing any of that now. And that bothers me, because I agree. And I've operated a business right alongside of DSIPA down there in the Roseburg area. Yeah, we had to make decisions about where we got our equipment and where we did this and where we did that. And we, too, made opportunities for some of our local business to use. But we had those local businesses supportive in there, because there were times when in the human error of things, or somebody would come to us and we didn't have supplies, and it wasn't until next week till we got our deliveries from our main people, and we utilized those local suppliers, and they were valuable to us. I would guess that I've seen the medical supply trucks a dozen times at the local hospitals, too. So they're also finding certain things that from time to time they need these people, and to work hardships on them in the overall setting doesn't make sense, because I've said it time and again, basically, OMAP has looked at these things as though they were in a silo and they were the only one that had to save money, and they haven't looked about what a little bit of effort on their part might do in some other arena. So this is where we're trying to surround this problem from.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that I would disagree with you in some of those characterizations, but I do get concerned when you absolutely hamstring the agency from even looking at opportunities to save money. And that would be our...
We wouldn't even been here if they'd come and talked to the industry. We wouldn't even be here. This is a last-ditch stand to try to get some kind of common sense and common working ground with what I consider to be an agency kind of running amok.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator George.
I cannot say that it's an absolute parallel, but I am really concerned about an incident that happened back in 1997. In fact, at that time, Representative Patty Millen had a hearing in which we talked about an area in which a constituent of mine had received a substantial amount of saline solution. I mean, substantial to the point it filled the back porch of the house, when what they needed was some sort of voucher to go locally and buy distilled water. And to me, the closer we can get that delivery to the individual, the better off we're going to be. And I can guarantee you that picking that up and actually disposing of the product, because it could not be, in my understanding, be put back in inventory, was a substantial cost. And I would just wonder, as we estimated any cost or savings, if we were making consideration of those kind of things that happened, like that incident. And if you'd like, I can go back and do further research as to how that whole thing came to pass. But my thought being is that this is probably, since the agency is taking this action by administrative rule, that maybe we do need to put a little stop in the way that says maybe the service to the customer would be the more important issue.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Mesler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a discussion out in the hallway, and I'd like clarification from these folks. You've heard our concerns here on the committee, as you've heard in the past. Do the Dash 2s resolve our problems? And I was told that maybe I was confused on what the Dash 2s do.
Mr. Chair, Senator Messerly, as I understand your concern, it is that you want local vendors to be able to provide durable medical equipment and medical supplies, including incontinence supplies. The Dash 2 amendments do that.
Thank you. I apologize for getting us off.
Well, that's no problem. I'm not sure sometimes we aren't all confused. And if we weren't confused, we probably wouldn't allow ourselves to be here.
And here it is writing.
We have a couple other folks who wish to testify, Tom Holt and Jacqueline Zimmer. I appreciate you folks coming, and go ahead, Tom.
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Tom Holt, the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. The Dash 2, I'm going to speak briefly to the Dash 2 amendments, and I'd just like to make a couple of comments. We had a round of testimony before on this bill, and I think you're all pretty clear on what it does. But just to clarify, the Dash 2 amendments do, in fact, resolve problem we're trying to solve and focus in on the supplies issue and exclude the eyeglasses and hearing aids, which was raised as a concern by OMAP in the previous hearing. So at this point, we're pretty satisfied with the bill as it would be amended. But I still find it curious that the dollars are a continuously moving target on this bill. We've heard everywhere from $93,000 to $700,000 in alleged savings by OMAPA, and what was not noted by the previous witnesses is the cost to vendors in the rule hearing where this was, came up, the estimate was $1.9 million. Now we're told that that was just a 9-month impact, and just did a little quick calculation. That means over the biennium, $5 million in costs to local businesses. I would suggest that in addition to the loss of service to the clients of OMAP, which really is our greatest concern here, the state would lose some percentage of that $5 million in lost tax revenue and would wash out even if we had allegedly $700,000 in savings. Would come awfully close to washing that away. But I'm just mystified by the continuously moving numbers on this. And I'll leave it to OMAP to at some point provide a definitive answer of what that really is. But this is a good bill that will...
Hope you have a long life to wait for the answer.
This is a good bill at this point as amended that will make sure that people under the Oregon Health Plan and the fee-for-service side, who are often the people with the worst conditions, that's where the long-term disabled folks are. They are not in the HMOs. They will be serviced in a way that provides them a degree of dignity that they deserve. That will conclude my testimony.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
Tom, I was looking at your letter, and it appears to me that what we're attempting to do is we go back to what we have been currently doing.
Chair Fisher and Senator George, yes, exactly so. The OMAP has not yet gone to the single source in incontinence supplies. They've indicated they plan to. Also curious is the fact that they had the rule hearing on it and then it was set aside before the rule, and but we still have that hanging over us.
Tom, were you at the original hearings?
Senator Fisher, I was not.
No. I just went back because the thing that really frustrates me is they're talking about approximately 10% savings, but they haven't even approached the people they're dealing with now and asked them if they could work out a 10% savings.
Yeah, Senator Fisher,
that really bothers me because that was offered by members of the industry, and as I said, there were very, very few representatives of industry and suppliers and providers in comparison to the numbers of folks from government agencies and other arenas that didn't have anything to do with the business end of things. There's no consideration of what that money, whether it's 1.9 or 5 or what it turns out to be, would do in the case of over to advancing the cause of revenue in the state, because it would be paying on taxes here rather than going somewhere out of state, potentially. This idea of 36-hour service to all places and guaranteed service to all places in the state, and I can just guarantee you that isn't going to happen.
Yes. Senator Fisher, I concur with that.
It's impossible to happen, and as you say, the changing amounts of money bother me. We were going on the information at that hearing that what we were furnished. Now we're being furnished something we can't even tie in with it. It wasn't my idea that we add extra employees here. That was put down by the very statement of the whole program. And I'm extremely frustrated at this point in time over this kind of thing. I don't like to lock any person in either, because I think we need options of bidding and operations. But when I just see something being done, almost like a backhand slap in the face. Most of us are always willing to work with people if we get in a tight kink or money becomes short or we're having a hard time with something, but to not even give people a chance to do that is extremely frustrating. I sense your frustration in the process.
Senator Fisher, if I may, I concur with those comments. We have, you know, our members have offered to work with OMAP to help them better manage, as I mentioned in the previous hearing. you know, one of the persistent issues that I hear anyway from my members who are involved in the supply of incontinence supplies is that they know how to select a better grade of product that would require, you know, fewer of them and actually save money over the cheap stuff that OMAP is willing to pay for. And, you know, there are things, that's just an example of the kind of thing that can be done if we are able to work together instead of you know, this kind of summary removal of incontinence supplies from local supply. And, you know, under the 36-hour issue, if someone goes incontinent, they haven't got 36 hours. You know, they need it right then, as you know. I did want to touch on one other thing that I neglected to mention, and I just wanted to respond to a comment that was made by Mr. Hetherington. He alluded to a need somehow to move dollars away from some vendors and some providers and give them to physicians. And that's a new element of an agenda here that is not something I think we should welcome. We need all the providers working together on this health plan to serve the enrollees and not be pitting providers against each other.
I would agree with that. Another thing that bothers me, this is a very, very short version of all the things that were listed and that were going to happen through the course of this process. As I recall, they were going to also limit incontinence supplies to 400 changes a month. Who's to say how many times somebody goes to the bathroom a month, depending on your condition? Is somebody going to have to lay there all day for the last 12 days with the same pad because they ran out ahead of time? I mean, there's just all kinds of problems with the things, and we're not getting in this letter that was in testimony here today anything close to what we heard. And right now I'm going to make a request from OMAP that they get us that material that was furnished to us at the hearing and get it here in front of this committee so we can compare it to this and see if we're answering all the problems and the things that were brought out with that particular piece of paper. And so the hearing that was held that Senator Messerly and I went to and testified at, I want the information that we were given on the program and the money that it saved and the people they were going to hire and all that kind of stuff. I want that brought in here and brought to our committee administrator as quickly as possible so it can be furnished to the committee members and we can get to the bottom of this thing. I don't see Jacqueline Zimmer anywhere here. Yes, Senator Messerly.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, as you read the report that we received today from the Department of Human Services, states that the funding, if we pass this bill, the funding that it would supposedly cost the state is not in the governor's budget. Do we need to send this to Ways and Means first, or do we need to ask the department to come in and give us real figures that aren't all over the board?
Too bad we can't get the governor in here.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that was kind of my question, if I could tag on with Senator Messerly, is that did the governor then anticipate that we were going to write administrative rules to do this? Was that part of building his budget?
Yes.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to tell you, I wrote a couple notes here because a few things go through your mind when you're listening to something like this. And I remember one of our state's greatest or great entrepreneurs, when he was trying to help a young lady in my district called Brandy Schroeder, and he said he couldn't comprehend that we had created a system that was so impersonal and it was so inflexible and appeared to be so uncaring. And his thought being is that the system must be flexible. It must be able to, at the local level, to be able to address individual concerns of people who have become, it's become necessary for them to avail themselves of this level of service. And, you know, I'm just kind of haunted by that because I saw the frustration in Mark Hemstreet's eyes and his voice that day as he articulated some of these ideas of his own personal frustration with what he thought was going to be a program that would help people that seemed to be so impersonal and so uncaring. So.
Also, I'm going to ask OMAP to furnish the list of the occupations of the Ancillary Services Committee so we can look that over. Let's make a... Probably someplace in my voluminous files have that information. I don't think I threw it away, but I don't know where to lay my hands on it. don't see Jacqueline Zimmer. Did she buzz off something? Did she?
No.
Okay. Yeah, but that's not, that doesn't carry any of the, now they had a whole long list of the different things and different rules that they were proposing to go into effect with this change in purchasing, going to a sole provider, or sole supplier. Thank you very much, Mr. Holt. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're going to bring this back as soon as we get more information on it, and we'll have a chance to study the effects of the amendment, and if possible, if any of the members have misconceptions, we can get that straightened out too in the meantime. So we will bring this back for work session. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 2567, and I believe that brings to an end the stuff for the material for the committee today, and thank you for your long suffering, and have a good weekend. Our committee is closed.